wear a bulletproof vest because I think there is at least one of the students in this class who's an objectivist, so I have to be very careful what I say. I don't want anyone attacking me, or even worse, not enrolling in my future classes because of something I say about Ayn Rand that isn't correct. So I'm counting, if there are any students who are objectivists, I'm counting on you. Be sure to correct me if I say anything that you think about Ayn Rand's views that is not correct. Now, the title of this lecture, although it's one I picked myself, I wonder whether it's really not such a good title, because when you see Mises versus Rand, it suggests they're enemies, that they're totally opposed, but that was by no means the case. They agreed very much on free market economics. They were both very much against socialism. And of course, Mises wrote the classic refutation of socialism, the socialist calculation argument, showing that in a complex economy, this socialism really couldn't work at all because it's unable to calculate. And Ayn Rand, of course, was also against socialism. They were opposed to intervention in the free market. They both believed in strictly in the free market. They were also in favor of strictly limited government. Both of them rejected anarchism. However, if you're sympathetic to anarchism, as I am, one should note that there are elements in Mises' views. He does say people have an unlimited right of secession, so this would really limit very much what the state could do. And in Ayn Rand's idea of government, although there is within a territory a monopoly agency that's doing all the defense and administration of justice protection, she doesn't think that this government has the right of taxation. So both of them have a really much more limited government than even you would expect with the phrase limited government. So they're in agreement on that. And it's more than just an agreement in views. In fact, in the Objectivist newsletter, which was the main publication of the Ayn Rand and her movement when it got started, there was a review that strongly recommended human action. The review, I think, was written by Nathaniel Brandon, who was later had a big falling out with Ayn Rand, and as you know, was purged from the group. Yes, and Danny's just reminding Mises called Ayn Rand the bravest man in America, and she was very happy to hear that. And Mises wrote Ayn Rand a letter after Atlas Shrugged appeared. He was very impressed with the novel, and he thought very highly of it. And in fact, the two of them, Mises and Rand, knew each other. Rand attended a few sessions of Mises' famous seminar at New York University, and she met with him socially a number of times. And Rand was even better acquainted with a close friend and follower of Mises, the columnist for the New York Times and later for Newsweek, Henry Hazlitt. A lot of you might be read his excellent book, Economics in One Lesson. And he also wrote, of course, Failure of the New Economics, and he wrote Foundations of Morality. He was a very important follower and colleague of Mises, and he was good friends with Ayn Rand. I should say here, probably because just a lot of you might be interested, Murray Rothbard's view of Rand, he was at first very negative. He was aware of her. I think he met her around 1954, but he, in his correspondence, he was first very negative. He thought that she had certain totalitarian tendencies, and there's letters where George Reisman also says that. However, when Atlas Shrugged appeared, Murray Rothbard was extremely impressed, when, not to say bowled over, by the novel, and he wrote Rand a letter saying that this was one of the greatest novels ever written. He was extremely impressed with it, and naturally she was happy to hear that. And Rothbard's group, which was called the Circle Bastiat, included Ralph Rako, Ronald Hamaway, Leonard Liggio, George Reisman, other people met for a while with the Rand's group, which Rand's group was called the Collective. And so they were getting, they got along very well, but they quarreled quite a bit. For one thing, Rand couldn't accept Rothbard's anarchism. Rothbard said, well, we shouldn't just have a limited government. We don't need any government at all. And Rand disagreed with that very much. And then they also had problems that that Murray Rothbard's wife was quite religious. She was a Protestant, and the objectivists were unhappy about that. They wanted her to listen to lectures by Nathaniel Brandon criticizing the proofs for existence of God, and she wouldn't do that. Also, Rothbard, you know, always had a terrific sense of humor, he and his group, they would make fun of certain rather pretentious ways people in the Rand circle would have. They did imitations of them. And then George Reisman, who was feeling guilty about having participated in this, told Brandon about this, and this got them into trouble. Then also there was an incident where Rothbard published an essay called The Mantle of Science, and the objectivist said he'd taken material, he had gotten an argument that against determinism from Barbara Brandon's master's thesis, and didn't cite her, but Rothbard said, no, this is a very common argument. They didn't seem to know that this wasn't an argument they'd originated. So they had a big falling out, and Reisman, who was a member of Rothbard's inner circle, decided that Rand was really right, and he joined the Rand's group, and he had a big falling out with Rothbard because of that. But so you see the relationship between Mises and Rand, and Mises' students and Rand, was not one of total enmity. They had a lot in common. So when you see the title lecture, Mises versus Rand, don't take this to mean they're totally opposed to each other. Now, although, as I said, Rand liked Mises' economics, and Danny's pointed out, Rand said if she had her way, all philosophy would be Aristotle, all education Montessori, and all economics Mises. She liked Mises' economics very much. She thought that he had the wrong philosophical principles. And the main source for her views on Rand is in marginal notes that she wrote in her copy of Human Action. And these are available in a volume called Ayn Rand's Marginalia, which was edited by Robert Mayhew, who's an objectivist philosopher who's written on Aristotle and specialist in Greek philosophy. I didn't put that on the reading list because in the reading list we have for the courses, what we try to do is have material that you can get online so you don't have to spend money getting the books. And unfortunately, the objectivists don't agree with the prevalent view at the Mises Institute, which is against intellectual property. They're very strict on copyright, so they don't have this material online, so you have to buy the book if you want to see it. So if some of the comments you can, by looking at the comments she made, you can see what she thought of Human Action. Some of them were a bit hard to make out because they were just marginal comments, but just notes to herself. But some of them were intended as questions for George Reisman, or comments to George Reisman. But you can get, if you read them, you can get a pretty good idea of what she didn't like about Mises' philosophical views, or where she disagreed with. Some of them are a bit amusing. Now, there's one where she's making fun. She said, well, Mises is supposed to be such a tremendously erudite person, but look, he made a mistake. He said, he had a sentence where he said, Lenin dissolved the Constituent Assembly in that was supposed to meet, right? And said, even though they had the elections, the Constituent Assembly were held under the auspices of the Bolshevik government, Lenin dispersed them in the beginning of 1918. And she has a note saying, well, look, he's supposed to be so erudite, but in fact, these elections were held under the provisional government, not under the Bolsheviks. And the thing that makes it that's funny is Mises was right about that. The Constituent Assembly was, that the plans for it were made during the provisional government. The elections were not held until after the Bolshevik Revolution. So Mises was quite right there. But that's just a side point. It's not one of the main things she's criticizing for. Now, the view that Rand held was that philosophy is really the fundamental, foundational discipline. So if you get things wrong in philosophy, in the basics, things will be wrong elsewhere. If foundations are wrong, then that's going to really interfere with things in the rest of the system. And you can see, I'll be mentioning a bit of this later, in the Randian view, they think that she and her followers, like Lenin and Peikoff, think Kant was really tremendously wrong in philosophy. So if you reply to them, well, but look, in his political thinking, political philosophy, Kant had views, was not a totalitarian. He believed to a large extent in classical liberalism. We'll say, well, the important thing really is the underlying philosophical beliefs. If he gets those wrong, doesn't matter what he says in politics, or what he says in politics will be infected by these wrong philosophical views. So when she says that Mises has wrong philosophy, this is a matter of tremendous importance for her. Now, to see what the basic point, the most important point where she thought he had the wrong philosophy, is really deals with this, and probably the issue that I've stressed the most in this course so far. One thing I try to stress, I give this over and over again, it never hurts to view, that Mises accepted a priori concepts. A priori concept is one that you have in advance of experience. And you remember, as I mentioned a number of times, Mises said that if you want to understand human behavior, we have to have the a priori concept of action in the various categories that involved in that concept. So these concepts are a priori in the sense that we need to have them before we can understand human behavior. If we don't have these a priori concepts, Mises thought, we're not going to be able to understand human behavior. Now, I suggested, well, maybe if you don't like the a priori or you think it's wrong, all you have to do is say these concepts are a priori in the sense that you have to have them before you can understand human behavior, but maybe they're not absolutely a priori. Maybe we could get them from experience about something else and then just have them a priori to human action, so they'd be kind of called local a priori rather than universal or global a priori. But Mises held this more far-reaching view also. He said that we need to have certain a priori concepts, for example, concept of causality, in order to understand any experience at all. So this is for Rand, this was a major problem, because she said there aren't any a priori concepts at all. There aren't any concepts that you have in advance of experience. So you can see how this is going to generate a major problem if you want to accept both Mises and Rand, because Mises said we need these a priori concepts to understand action, to understand experience. But Rand said there aren't a priori concepts. According to her, all concepts come from experience. By experience, she means what we learn through the senses, sight, hearing, touch, smell, and taste. That's experience. We get all our concepts through the senses. So how do we do that? And she said that we do this through what she called, I see Bill is here. Bill, you were the one I was worried about. I had in mind when I said I have to have my bulletproof vest, so I'm sure you'll be watching in case I say the wrong thing. Yeah, so what she thought is we got these concepts through measurement and mission. They're, as Bill says, they're objective, they're part of experience. This example, mine, suppose you see a matchstick, a steel rod, and a conductor's baton. So what you can do is you drop the differences and you get the feature these have in common, namely length. So that's how you'd acquire the concept of length. It's there in what the senses give you, bound up with these particular objects, but you drop the particular features of the various objects and you see what they have in common. This is what she means by measurement omission. So that's how, according to her, that's how you get concepts. You don't have the concepts a priori before experience. They're not innate ideas. She didn't think there were any innate ideas. We just get concepts in this way by abstracting them through this measurement omission from experience, from what the senses tell us. Now, what are the advantages, according to her, of having concepts, of having these abstractions, process measurement omission from experience? Well, she says, if we have concepts, then this enables us to think without keeping all the details of reality in mind. Say, if I want to say something about length, I don't have to have in mind all the objects that I've come across that have the dimension of length, or the steel rods, the conductor's baton, matchsticks, all sorts of other things. I can just have this abstract concept and think of, and deal with that, and I don't have to have these other things in mind. But now here's what's a very distinctive part of Rand's view that's very different in her philosophy from other philosophers. There are many other philosophers who have this same kind of empiricist theory of concepts, that we get concepts by abstraction from experience. That doesn't make her that distinctive position. There are, you find it's a very common view in philosophy, although particular way she writes about measurement omission, I think, is something fairly original. I think is original to her, but the basic notion of abstraction is one that she shares with other people. Now, what she says, though, I think this is a very distinctive view. I won't say no other philosophers have this, but it is very much one she had. She says that the meaning of a concept is all the items it designates and all their characteristics. So I misspelled there. How stupid of me. Well, I guess I'll fail basic English. Okay, so length doesn't mean, according to her, just this abstraction, what you get when you have measurement and mission. Length means, in the sense it designates, it points to all the objects that have length and all the characteristics of those objects. Now, people who don't, so in a sense, meaning is pointing. When you're talking about the meaning of something, you're really pointing to all the things that have it. Now, people who don't like this theory made fun of it, this pointing theory of meaning. They call it the Fido theory, after, say, someone, you have a dog, his name is Fido, so the word Fido in quotation mark points to the dog. So people who don't like this theory kind of make fun of it. They say, well, this is a Fido theory, meaning it just, there are other ways words acquire or concepts acquire meaning than pointing, but according to this theory, they take all concepts that they're pointing to things. I should say, the one I think called it this Fido, not, he wasn't talking about Rand, but he was just making fun of this kind of theory, called, had this phrase Fido, was Gilbert Ryle, who was a philosopher at Oxford and was prominent in the 1930s, 40s, and through the 60s at Oxford. So, again, according to Rand, the concept is pointing to all the object, means all the objects that it applies to and all the characteristics of those objects. And now, according to her view, an essence, when we talk about essences are not something out in reality, but an essence is a mental construct that best accounts for the objects and their characteristics. So we talk about the essence of water, that would be what best accounts for all the water there is and the characteristics that water has. So it would be a really kind of the best theory of water that we have now would be the essence of water. So you see how this is a very different view of concepts from the one that Mises had, because Mises said, well, we have these a priori concepts, but she said, no, there aren't any a priori concepts. We get concepts through experience in this way. Now, what I'm trying to do in this lecture is not so much to evaluate Rand and Mises, but just to give you an idea of what the views are. But I will just give you a few problems as I see it with Rand's theory, and this is where I really better put on, make sure my bulletproof vest is on properly. I should say, in the summer, I'm going to be giving a course for Mises Academy on philosophy of Ayn Rand, so we'll be dealing with some of these theories in more detail, not just in comparison, just in comparison with Mises. So one problem with Rand's theory, this is not a refutation of it, but when you read her account and views of other people who hold that view, say if you look at Introduction to Objectivist Epistemology, they don't really give arguments in favor of the theory. They just say, well, here's how we acquire concepts, and they'll explain that. But they don't really tell you why that's true, why we should believe that. Suppose you said to Rand, well, this is what you say, this is how we acquire concepts, but I don't think that's how we do acquire concepts. what would be the arguments for her view. They don't really tell you. They have arguments for all sorts of other views that they hold, but for the theory of concepts, they don't really say very much or why you should accept this theory. They just present the theory. Maybe they think once you understand it, then you'll just realize that it's true, but they don't really argue for it. Now, another question one might have is, why does there have to be a single theory that explains all concepts? Why can't it be, say, we get some concepts by abstraction from experience, but we have others that are a priori? Why does it have to be a single theory for all concepts? And then there seem to be problems for certain, how we would acquire certain concepts by abstracting them from things in the world by this process of measurement omission that I mentioned. Suppose we have, what about negative concepts like not? How would we get the concept of not or no by measurement omission? Suppose we have the sentence, there are no rhinoceroses in this room. How did we get that concept? No, now let me see, there's a question here. Now, Anish asked a very good question. Does Rand think the Aristotelian laws of thought are sense-derived? And he raises a problem if you say, yes, they are sense-derived, which is similar to the problem I'm going to be talking about just now. And the answer is yes, Rand does think that Aristotelian laws of thought are really derived through induction from experience. This is the they really place a great deal of emphasis on induction. I'll be doing that a bit later in the lecture, that we do get everything through induction. Now, the problem Anish mentioned in this lecture is actually quite similar, if not identical, to this next problem I'm going to mention, is if we say we get a concept by measurement omission, like we get the concept of length by looking at various long objects or objects which have length and then dropping the details of the objects and just coming up with what they have in common. Some philosophers think, well, don't we have, before, if we can, how would we be able to do that? How would we be able to come up with this common concept unless we had it to begin with? Maybe if we didn't have a concept, we would just see kind of a confused blur of particulars. We didn't have the concept, we wouldn't be able to get it through abstraction. That, and of course, the people who like this theory don't accept that criticism, but that's one of the objections that people have given to this kind of abstractionism, as the theory is called in general philosophy. And two philosophers who were given this objection here, Peter Geech and Jerry Fodor, they raise this problem. They say, well, if against this theory that we get concepts by abstraction from the empirical world, from the world of sense, they say, don't we have to have the concepts in order to be able to get them from the empirical world? How could we cut away all the details unless we had the concept to begin with? So I say I'm not intending here to give an evaluation really of the theory. I just want to indicate what are some objections that some philosophers would have to the theory, or what are some possible problems with it. Now Bill, rising to Rand's defense, as one might expect, says that he feels that a strength of her theory is that it avoids charges of subjectivism or intrinsicism, or avoids analytic synthetic arguments. I think that would be certainly a point if you accept the objectivist views on these other topics you mentioned. You're certainly right. It fits in well with other objectivist concepts, but people who don't agree with those things might not take that as such a point in its favor. So see, I think you're right that the whole objectivist philosophy is very interconnected. So I think that's a very good point you raised. Now, question might be, might expose you, you think quite a bit of this. Yes, now this example, Danny gives an example of a statue, and that's one I've sometimes used, somebody's trying to explain, I actually use that very example, say, well, somebody's trying to explain how Michelangelo constructed one of his statues, and say, well, he just chipped away everything that didn't look like the subject, and that's what he came up with. That's a very good way of indicating this problem with the theory. So, suppose you, like Bill or other people, suppose you like this theory of concept formation, but you're also, you like what Mises had to say. So can you reconcile them in some way? Can you say, well, okay, I can accept what Rand says about how we get concepts, but I'd like to salvage as much as possible of Mises economics and Mises praxeology, taking account what Rand said about concept. So it would seem like you couldn't get very far with this project, because if Rand is right, then we have to throw out Mises kind of a priori knowledge, because if there are no a priori concepts, how can we have a priori knowledge? But praxeology is supposed to be an a priori science, so don't we have to throw out praxeology if we accept what Rand says about concept? Well, one possible escape, and then this is going to get us into some other objectivist views, we can distinguish between a priori concepts from a priori knowledge. Now, a priori concept, as I mentioned before, is one that we have before we experience something. We have a concept apart from experience. But a priori state, if we know something a priori, you know a statement a priori, that means we can know it's true apart from experience. So that doesn't say anything about how we get the concepts in the statement, just that once we got the statement, then we can know it apart from experience. So suppose it turns out to be true that we get the concept of numbers from experience. It might be that 2 plus 2 equals 4 can still be known a priori. We can know that just by thinking about it, the statement, not by testing it by experience. I should say one refinement. Bill says doesn't see Mises' conclusion. Yes, this is that's right. It's just the problem is what the problem is supposed to be with Mises' view that we know these various conclusions a priori. You could certainly hold that Mises is right, but he's come up with these. What he says is really just empirical generalization. I'll be mentioning some points about that later, but the problem I'm concerned with now is just the conflict between a priori, the a priori view concept, and what Rand says about concepts. There aren't a priori concepts. So what I'm suggesting now is, well, is there an escape? We say, well, even if we get the concepts through experience, maybe we can still know them, still have a priori knowledge, because if you know something a priori, it's that you can know it to be true apart from experience. I should say just one refinement. Actually, notice I said you can know it apart from experience. It doesn't follow from that you couldn't know it by experience as well. And supposing there's some, say, fairly complicated mathematical proposition like 2 plus 2 equals 4, that you couldn't figure out by yourself, but you think it's true because your math teacher told you this, and your math teacher is very reliable. Your math teacher said to you 2 plus 2 equals 4, so you believe it and you come to know it. So there, you know it through experience, but it could still a priori because it can be known apart from experience. So I say this is one possible reconciliation. But you see, I've played a bit of a trick because I suggested a possible reconciliation. Reconciliation is that if we reject a priori concepts, maybe we can have a priori knowledge. I suggest possible reconciliation, but if you're ramming, if you're objectivist, you won't be able to accept this reconciliation. Rand wouldn't accept this solution. In her view, you can't know something to be true just by thinking about it. A concept always refers to all the items it designates, and true statements or inductive generalizations from experience. So she would say 2 + 2 = 4. Well, 2 designates all the couples of objects out there in the world. It's something we get by abstraction from all these couples. So when we have 2 + 2 = 4, this is a generalization we've gotten, a very reliable one, by abstraction. It isn't something we get just by thinking about it. Now, there are two philosophers, Roderick Long, some may know him, a very good friend of mine who's given seminars at the Mises Institute with him, who's very influenced by Ayn Rand. He's not a strict Randian, but he's very influenced by him. And Gregory Brown, I don't know him, but he's another philosopher who's been influenced by Rand. They suggested maybe Rand could allow what they call shallow kinds, which are concepts that don't refer to all the items that the concept designates, but just identify concepts through certain essential attributes. So if we did that, maybe we could just, if we just knew all the essential attributes, then we could think about the, get knowledge just by thinking about the concept, because once we know the essential attributes, we wouldn't need any, to look at the rest of it, anything else in the empirical world. Now, there may be something to that, but it's not really objectivist in spirit. The objectivist view is Rand has it as the concept designates all the objects that it refers to and all their characteristics. So I don't think a strict Randian would accept this compromise. They would say not only are there no a priori concepts, there's no a priori knowledge either. Now, I've suggested one escape from the view that what we said, the Rand views about the a priori posed to Mises. The escape was, well, first say, Rand says there aren't any a priori concepts. Maybe you could say there's no a priori concepts, but maybe there is a priori knowledge. And I said, no, she wouldn't accept that either, because she thinks that there isn't a priori knowledge. Knowledge is just derived inductively through experience. We can't just know something by thinking about certain concepts. One way we might think, again, to accept, yes, now Bill has added a very useful clarification that Rand thinks knowledge is contextual. So we're always dealing with reality. We're pointing out that, so I think this is a very good, Bill, you're quite right, that is what Rand said. So one way we might try to deal with what Rand says about the a priori, he said, well, instead of talking about a priori, we should talk about necessary truth and say what Mises is really establishes certain necessary truths about human action, about economics. So it's important to understand what difference is when we talk about difference between a priori and necessary. Now, when we talk about, say, distinction between a priori, something we get before experience, and a posteriori, something derived from experience, this is an epistemological distinction. It's asking, how do we know something? Is it that we know it from experience, or do we know it apart from experience? We're dealing here with epistemology. But when we talk about necessary truth, we're not talking about how we know things. We're not talking about epistemology. We're talking about the what's the nature of the world. We talk about ontology and metaphysics. But the issue is, what is the world like, not how we know the world. So here, the distinction here, necessary truth is one that couldn't be otherwise. Say, example, you can't mix red and green and get a new color. That's an, if that's true, it's a necessary truth. Dante asks, can axioms be considered a priori? And not in the Randian view. No, they think axioms are derived, inductive generalizations. Bill, I'm not so up on colors. I don't think you would get purple if you mix red and green, but you can try it and see what happens. Yeah, that's right. I think it's red and blue, not red and green. Anish asked, is Rand view completely existential? I don't think so, because she says it's the characteristics of the concepts as well as the item it designates, although it might be characteristics would be further explainable in existential terms. That's an interesting question I'd have to go into. So it, in contrast with necessary truth, something that couldn't be otherwise, the contingent truth could have been otherwise. Say the earth is capable of supporting life. Well, maybe if things had been different, say the mixture of gases had been different, maybe the earth wouldn't have been capable of supporting life. So we could say that seems to be contingent. So if you, one proposal would be to say, instead of talking about, in praxeology, about a priori truths, maybe you could talk about necessary truths instead. Say, Rothbard adopted this approach because he was in philosophy, was very influenced by Aristotle and Thomas Aquinas. He'd also agreed with Rand. I don't think he's had her exact theory concept, but he agreed with her that concepts are all derived from experience. But he said, well, we can just say we have necessary truths. And he thought, whether rightly or wrongly, that when Mises talks about a priori truths, he really had in mind something very similar to necessary truths in the way I just explained that. That's probably, I don't think, right, but that's what Mises thought, but that's the way he took it. Yes, now Bill's getting into something I'm just going to be giving in my next slide, so I'm glad you mentioned that. Now, Rand would have problems with this solution. The objectivists wouldn't accept this distinction, but because it involves a distinction between necessary and contingent truth. According to Rand, everything that happens is necessary except for human choices. So what Rand would say, I gave an example of a contingent, say it appears contingent, one that doesn't have to be true. It's just true, but it could have been otherwise. The earth is capable of supporting life. And I think if I'd understood Rand correctly, she would say, that isn't contingent. That's just the way reality is. And aside from human choices, reality is what it is. They like Rand's always say existence exists. They just mean reality is whatever it is. We can't make this distinction within reality between things that must be and things that could have been otherwise except for human choice. And a key statement of explaining their view of this is in an article, a famous article, The Analytic Synthetic Dichotomy by Leonard Peikoff, who was Rand's literary executive and the heir to her estate. And you can find this in Introduction to Objectivist Epistemology. Now, why does Rand think that everything except human choices is necessary? Well, basically, she thinks that first she thinks an object's causal properties are part of its identity. So supposing we talk about how the Earth came to develop a mixture of gases in the atmosphere, this would be because various things that caused those gases to be there. And causation had to happen in the way it actually took place, because an object's causal properties are part of its identity. So we know the law of identity, A is A. So we say the causal properties follow from the identity, and this means whatever happens in the world really had to happen. So the actual world, the world we're in, is the only possible world. Now, again, what I'm going to try to do in this lecture is not really to evaluate or to try to refute what Rand says, but to really just explain what the view is, so we can contrast it with what Mises said and understand how the two thinkers are different. But I will mention a couple problems for it. First, it isn't clear that the law of identity implies that objects have always caused whatever they do in the same way. I mean, supposing there are various ways, I mean, it's certainly, if an object has certain causal properties, those are part of its identity. It's not clear why you would have to hold that the causal properties always have to operate in the identical way. At least I'm not seeing immediately why that follows from the law of identity. But even if it does, suppose you say causal properties follow from the law of identity just the way Rand and Peikoff thought, it's not clear that they're right, that everything other than human choices had to be the way it is, because what we would know is, given a sort of set of objects, let's say we start with certain objects, and we would know that the objects at any subsequent time would be caused by the objects at this time. But how we know how those are the only possible set of objects, it doesn't follow that even if an object has certain... Yes, Bill, I just raised a problem for the point you suggested is implying that law of causation follows from A is A, but even if it does, how do we know those are the only possible set of objects? So we know that given a set of objects, they operate in a certain fixed way, given this contention that law of causation follows from law of identity, but how do we know those are the only possible objects? That's a possible problem for this view, but that was the view she held, regardless of what you think of these objections to it. So I'll just say one further problem is that it seems counterintuitive to say that statements like it might have turned out that the gravitational constant was slightly different from the actual figure are necessarily false, but that is what an objectivist would hold, if I've understood the view correctly. So if you accept Rand's position, then the principles of economics are not, as Mises thought, epistemologically special. That doesn't show there's anything wrong with the principle of economics, but they're inductive generalizations like the rest of science. So you remember I mentioned at the beginning of the course that Mises says, I mentioned several times, Mises said, well, economics has a distinct contribution to make to epistemology. And so Rand said, no, that's not right. She says in the Marginal Notes, you know, an economist would naturally say that because it's his discipline, but it isn't correct. She doesn't think economics has this particularly distinct contribution to make to epistemology. Now, another consequence, this affects, you know, in the course, what we're doing is Mises' epistemology, not his economic theory very much, but she has criticisms of his economics as well, the actual economics in the real world. And some of you, if you read Human Action or other works, Austrian economics like Man, Economy, and State, you're familiar with what Mises calls the evenly rotating economy, which is a condition where really everything, really the basic economic magnitudes, really remain constant. People just keep repeating the same actions over and over. And she thinks this is a confused and contradictory idea, just departs from reality too much. And in fact, if you're familiar with modern analytic philosophy, a lot of philosophers will use these very odd counter imaginary constructions. They'll say things like, imagine that instead of being here in the real world, say, instead of you're now listening to my lecture, but you suppose that you're really not listening to my lecture, you're just having various sensations. If you were listening to my lecture, were you really brains in a vat manipulated by a mad scientist to think that you're listening to my lecture? You have to be a pretty mad scientist to want to make people listen to this lecture, but never mind that. But so, philosophers who were in this objectivist tradition, like Tibor McCann, others have been very critical of this kind of coming up with these imaginary counter possibilities, imaginary examples. They say, no, we have to stick to the way things are in the actual world. The actual world is the only possible world. So this is one thing that she rejects. Now, I've stressed so far that Rand is very critical of a priori concepts, a priori knowledge, and as Bill pointed out, I think a few comments about, she says existence is primary, consciousness is dependent on existence. Now, why does she devote so much attention to criticizing the a priori? Of course, she thinks she's giving correct views on the matter, but why does she think this is such an important topic? And she thinks that, and I think she's right, that the a priori is a crucial part of Kant's philosophy. Kant said that we use a priori concepts to construct the phenomenal world. So Kant said we don't, according to her, she said, we don't know the real world, just the world as it seems to us. You remember Kant's famous Copernican revolution said, well, we have this skeptical problem. How do we know that what we think is corresponds to reality? So Kant said, well, philosophers have tried to solve this in the wrong way because they say, well, how do we know our concepts conform to the world? Because actually it's the world conforms to our concepts. So Rand said, well, if you think that, then you're saying we don't know the real world. We're separated from the real world. We're just really confined to what we know in our own minds, that we're separated from the real world, and this leads the way to all sorts of irrationalist views. Now, we won't be able to discuss this in any detail here, but we can raise the point, is this a correct reading of Kant? Now, he says we know the phenomenal world, we don't know what he calls the noumenal world. But if you say, does it follow from that point that Kant said we don't know the real world? Well, what's the premise you have to put in to get that? If Kant says we know the phenomenal world, not the noumenal world, what premise do we need to add to say, to get the conclusion Kant thinks we don't know the real world? And anybody tell me, what is the premise we need? We start with, Kant says, we know the phenomenal world, not the noumenal world. We want to have the conclusion, we don't know the real world. So what do we need is the missing premise. Is anybody? Yes, that's right. The real world is this noumenal world. One might deny it or might say, well, the phenomenal world is the world that the laws of logic and causality apply to. That's a pretty real. So we might question what is the correct reading of Kant. But that was the view that, in any event, that Rand held. And she thought that Kant's view had very bad consequences in history. And in fact, if you look at the famous book by Peikoff called Ominous Parallels, the objection is really blame the rise of Nazism on general acceptance of Kant's philosophy and what they consider its attendant irrationalism. So if you're interested in that, you can read that book. I once got into tremendous trouble about 30 years ago because I wrote a review of Ominous Parallels that was less than enthusiastic, and the objectivists really didn't like my review very much, so it caused some trouble. It was probably my most notorious review in a lifetime of writing negative reviews. Now, suppose that Rand's reading of Kant is correct. Does this make Mises vulnerable to the charge that he divorces knowledge from reality? According to Rand, Kant says that our knowledge is confined to this phenomenal world that we construct, but that isn't the real world. So is Mises vulnerable to this claim if you accept her reading of Kant? Well, Mises doesn't say that our concepts bar us from acquaintance in the real world. There are a few passages that you could take that way in his works, but I think he generally doesn't say that. He does think there are limits to human knowledge. He thinks there we face certain ultimate, what he calls the ultimate given, that we can't explain further. But it doesn't follow that insofar as our concepts do give us knowledge that these concepts don't give us knowledge of the real world. Just from the fact that, according to him, our knowledge is limited, doesn't follow that we don't know what we, in fact, can grasp. So I don't think, yes, Bill says Kant wanted to destroy reason, hence inventing noumenal. His objective was to defend his ethics, self-sacrificial altruism. Yes, that is you're very correct, and that is what Rand thinks. You're quite right. I mean, this isn't, as we'll see, this isn't what Mises thought about ethics, but that's what Rand thought about Kant. You're right. So as I said, but I don't think, even if you accept what Rand says about Kant, I don't think you would say Mises Okay, I'm back now. Good. So Mises didn't, I mean, Rand wouldn't accept what I said about Mises and knowing the world, because she rejected what he said about the limits of knowledge. For example, Mises says that human choice is what he calls an ultimate given. According to Mises, we have good reason to think that our choices are determined we can't find out what these causes are. Now, Rand said, no, this is wrong. We know we have free choice. So our belief that we have free choice isn't just a product of lack of knowledge. And she doesn't like, or she rejects, unanalyzable ultimate given. She said, no, we have to trace everything back to concepts that are derived from the empirical world in this process of abstraction that I try to explain. Now, one thing I should say, Rand makes what I consider a very interesting comment about Mises' attitude toward metaphysics. Bill says, well, even if Mises is wrong about praxeology's contribution to epistemology, his applications result from his ideas applied to the real world. His conclusion limited by reality, no problem for me. Well, I'll mention a little bit about that when I just try to bring this lecture to a conclusion. You're anticipating what I'm going to be mentioning next. So, but what Rand says about Mises in metaphysics is, she says, although Mises rejected logical positivism, remember I talked about that, I think, in my second lecture, he agreed with them that metaphysics, the claim that we can know the nature of reality, we can have these kind of general truths about being, that he agreed with them that there was no such discipline. And in fact, I think she's right that Mises is very critical of scholastic metaphysics, say metaphysics of Aquinas and Aristotle, but he doesn't say much about it. He has a footnote where I think we mentioned some work by Louis Rougier, very critical of scholastic metaphysics. But I think she's right, Mises doesn't think much of metaphysics. So I thought that was an interesting point she made. Now we're going to deal with the point that Bill was raising. Well, if you suppose you like Rand's epistemology and metaphysics, couldn't you just say Mises has the wrong philosophical views, but we just recast praxeology on a more empirical basis? Well, Rand has in these marginal notes, she has some criticisms, not only of the philosophy, but certain aspects of the economics as well. First of all, she rejects Mises' view that economics is part of a more general logic of choice. Remember I mentioned this, Mises says, economics isn't just dealing with buying and selling on the market or just making money, it's part of a more general logic that applies to choice. She said, no, when you talk about choice, this is investigating choice belongs to nature, choice belongs to philosophy. It's not part of economics. And as I say, she disagrees with specific contentions of praxeology. For example, Mises says that prices are determined by subjective values, the values that people have, the values, certain value scales, and that on the basis we can get demand and supply, we derive the law of marginal utility, we get explanation of prices. Rand says that values are objective, not subjective. And for Rand, when she talks about objective, she doesn't mean intrinsic. She doesn't mean something has value in itself apart from human beings. She thinks values are relative to man's life, but the requirements of life are a matter of fact. It isn't what do human beings need to survive? That's a matter of fact. It's not subjective. Now, you might think, well, when Rand is saying, is it criticizing subjective values, she's just talking about a different sense of values from Mises. Mises is talking about the preferences that people actually have, and Rand is talking about less objectively necessary to preserve life. So you don't have to have any conflict between them. Just say, well, they just talk about two different things. Randy's talked about values in the sense of what you need to live, the objective needs to live, and Mises is talking about what the subjective preferences people happen to have. But Rand didn't agree with this. She thought that prices are, contrast to Mises, she thought that prices are a measure of objective value. And the 19th century classical economists were right in looking for a theory of objective price. And if you read the book of her follower, George Riesman, who was also a student of Mises, friend of mine, I should say, if you read his great treatise, Capitalism, he tries to combine Mises with the great 19th century classical economist David Ricardo. So you see, Rand not only differed with Mises on foundations, but she had some differences from his actual economics as well. She didn't agree with him on subjective basis of prices. Now, I'll just finish up with some, Rand had some other things she disagreed with Mises. Bill, I'll get to your, let's see what Mises, yes, well, Bill, I just covered your question. You're right that they're dealing with different, when talking about values, they have in mind different things, but Rand also rejected what, at least some of what Mises said about subjective value in the sense that he meant not just, she wasn't just using value in a different way for him, but she specifically rejected some of what he said about subjective values in his sense. Now, she also had a great deal of trouble with Mises' contention that all action is rational. Remember, when I discussed it, we said Mises just means that everyone uses what he thinks are appropriate means to achieve his ends. But Rand, and you see this in a number of her comments, found this puzzling. She couldn't figure out why would Mises say that all action is rational. She said a lot of people do things that are irrational. But I think here she's just not taking rationality the way Mises is. And you remember last lecture, I was talking about Mises' concept of specific understanding and use of ideal types. Well, Rand didn't like those ideas either, because she said all correct concepts have to have exact definitions and be correctly derived by measurement and emission from the real world, and specific understanding and ideal types don't meet those requirements. So she didn't agree with, she didn't accept that either. And there were also some differences between them on ethics, important differences, but I'll deal with those a bit in my next lecture, which is the last lecture in the course. So I think I've gone a bit over, so I'll stop now and we can have some questions, objections. So far, nobody's fired any shots at me. Dante asks, he says, why don't you suggest subjective explanatory values are not the opposite of objective? Well, I think this is quite correct, but in fact, somebody could, and I think Bill has also indicated, somebody could say, well, I agree with what Rand said, we have certain objective values, certain things are objectively necessary for human survival, but we still, in explaining economics, need to take on what the preferences people actually have, so we take on their subjective values. I think that's certainly a consistent position, but it isn't the one that Rand herself held about subjective value. I don't think she would hold that because of her notion of objective values that you couldn't have such a concept of preferences that people actually have, but she didn't think that was the correct thing to use, concept to have in economics. Bill says, well, possible Brown was wrong about subjective value theory. Well, Bill, I'm afraid I'm going to have to email the Ayn Rand Institute reporting your deviation there. You're in big trouble. I'm sorry. Now, Anish says here that doesn't understand the objection to a priori concept. Now he says, can't we just take a priori concepts as axioms? Well, I think what Rand held was that axioms have to be derived by induction from the empirical world also. I won't tell George. I know him very well. Do you know George Reisman? I know him quite well. I haven't been in touch with him so recently, but I do know him. Yes. I used to have Thanksgiving dinner at his house a number of years ago. Anish says, isn't it permissible to use axioms or non-assumption leads to contradiction? Well, I think certainly that would be a very good reason to use an axiom, but an objectivist would say, and I should say if you haven't gathered it, I'm not an objectivist, but an objectivist would say it's true. You can certainly have axioms that in the sense of propositions that you must accept on pain of contradiction, but you get those axioms by inductive generalization. So it isn't that the fact that you can't deny it with contradiction doesn't imply, at least according to them, that you can get the axiom without getting it, inducing it through experience, you see. So it's a rather different way of looking at axioms from probably the way you're familiar with, or most people do. Now, Danny asked, how is Rothbard's Aristotelian epistemology similar or different from Rand's? Well, I think Rothbard didn't write an enormous amount about this, but he would say that concepts are abstracted from experience, but he didn't have this kind of very strict way of looking at the way we get concepts. Rand didn't say sort of we have to take concepts really as kind of condensations of experience. He just said sort of we get them in some way from experience, but he didn't have, I don't think he had in mind this very detailed process that she did. He really didn't say all that much about it, but I mean, I don't think he, in principle, reject all a priori concepts, or at least not with the same degree of strictness as Rand would. Now, Richie says, where is the inductive generalization come? It seems that this comes from experience. Well, it's just you, according to her, you start with experience and you get the abstractions, and then the laws are further generalizations. Once you have the concepts, you get further generalization. I don't think it's a regress. I don't accept the view myself, but I'm not clear why it would be a regress. And he says, how do you get, if knowledge is contextual, how do you get determined scope without granting the validity of abstraction? Well, I think that would be, they would grant the validity of abstraction. I mean, you could certainly have some problems, as you say, problems of idealism, how would you know one thing without knowing all else? Well, it's interesting, you know, there's one writer, Chris Sciabarra, who thinks that Rand does have some view of internal relations where everything is really related to everything else. So there, he does, according to him, there is kind of some parallel between Rand and the idealists who believed in internal relations. And then you mentioned the scholastic solution. I don't think Rand wrote about that very much. Well, for me, is rationality doesn't have anything to do with the ends. You know, you have whatever goals you want, and action is rational. So an altruist, you would just say, well, you know, that's what the person wants, and then the action is rational in the sense it's using whatever means he thinks appropriate to achieve his end. Now, I think Rand would say altruism in the sense that spoke, you're sacrificing yourself for something you don't regard as a value. It's not something you help, but you just say you regard it as your moral duty. It's somehow imposed on you to sacrifice yourself. I think she would say that's objectively wrong. Did Rand address the apparent, Ross says, and address the apparent massive contradiction between her concept of free will as independent of biological causality? Well, the objectivist view, again, as I understand it, is they think that human beings really don't have instincts at all. They tend to be very critical of people who say we're biologically wired to behave or act in certain ways. So I think there are various objectivist writers who criticize the notion of instinct. Yes, Bill, that's right. I think that's how she does say, talk about abstraction. Now, Dante says a ball cannot be all red and blue at the same time. It's a priori true. At the same time, it's necessary. And so it doesn't a priori equal an axiom, because the opposite would imply a contradiction. There are some a priori propositions are necessary. I mean, at least on some readings, you wouldn't have to say that an a priori truth is necessary. Supposedly, I'm thinking of the proposition, I now exist. I'd say that's a priori. I don't need experience to know that it's true. In fact, I couldn't deny it without contradicting myself, but it's not necessary. I might not have existed. Now, also, it wouldn't be true that all a priori statements or all necessary statements or axioms, I mean, some of them might be derived from other a priori or necessary statements, so they wouldn't be axiomatic. I see there's an interesting debate between Anish and Bill going on. They kind of, and he says, how does Rand come to the conclusion that the principle of induction is valid? If this is based on induction, it would have to be based on induction. I see. So questions, how do we know? Well, I think that's a very interesting point. That similar question we raised about John Stuart Mill, who I think was accused of giving inductive justification and induction. I think Rand has a view that our concepts, as I said, are sort of direct, really just simplifications of reality. So we just omitted things from reality. So, and the laws would also be really just ways of putting together the concepts. So she would say, I think, inductive principle isn't a separate principle from reality. It's just really a way of simplifying what's actually given in the world. So it isn't a separate principle that we're getting and applying to reality. It's just really something that's kind of drawn from the world directly. It isn't derived by some. It isn't that we're having some kind of separate principle that we're applying. It is if, imagine, maybe this is a way of looking at it again. I'm not an objectivist, I'm not sure I'm explaining this in the way they would, but imagine that inductive generalization would be something like a long range, sort of picture of the world kind of from far away. As we get closer and closer, we're getting the world in all its details, and so we get sort of like a Google map, you know, we're getting closer and closer to the real world. So the generalizations are really like the sort of what we get when we're taking away some of the details, but they're not separately derived. They're really there in the world, but they're just, we've omitted a lot of other things, so they're right there in the world. Yes, Rand, Danny wants to know what Rand thought of David Hume. She didn't like him much. She thought he was a skeptic who denied our knowledge of reality. I think there's some treatment of Hume in Omnis Parallel and other lectures by Peacock. They don't like Hume either. I should say, I mentioned she wrote on Mises, she really hates Hayek. Now Matthew says, is there any similarity between this Fido and Wittgenstein's picture theory? There is some similarity there. It's not that, you're right, that was, and then of course Wittgenstein came to reject that theory, and when Gilbert Ryle criticized this Fido theory, he had in mind some of Wittgenstein's criticisms of this, so it's a very good point you raised. Just know, did Rand ever Johnson or someone like that, or who did Rand. So I had some of the objectivists or objectivist sympathizers discussed Menger and Bombard, but I don't think Rand herself did. But I say that as far as I know, Rand didn't discuss Menger Bombard herself, but some of the objectivist sympathizers have or followers. And in the Journal of Ayn Rand Studies I put on the reading list, I think there's an article by a man's name is Johnson who discusses Menger and Rand. She has, I mentioned in this book, Marginalia, she has comments on various books that she's read. And one of them is Road to Serfdom, and she thinks that Hayek is really a complete sellout. He's really not had it. He's allowing all sorts of interferences with the market. He doesn't have a genuine concept of liberty at all. one thing I should say, she's also, one thing she's critical of Mises as well as Hayek, I didn't mention this in the lecture because it has more to do with ethics. She doesn't, Mises sometimes says, in the free market, the capitalists are really the servants of the consumers, because what the firms are doing, they're trying to produce whatever the consumers want. So you have consumer sovereignty. Rand can't stand that view. She said, no, this is not recognizing really the creator, the creative value of the capitalist. It's not the capitalist, and not as in her heroes. They're not just conforming to what the consumers want. She doesn't like when Mises says, he used the principle that labor has disutility. She says, she has one note where she said, George, referring to George Reisman, it's hard to see why one should go on with the book after you read that labor has disutility. So you see, she had quite a few disagreements with Mises, even though she got along with him and praised his defense of the free market. She had quite a few disagreements with it. Yes, he does discuss Hegel and Nietzsche. What he thinks is that they really carried further the irrationalism that Kant had laid the foundations for, that they were further stages in the development of German irrationalism. You know, it's interesting, if you compare ominous parallels with a book by Georg Lukács, the famous communist philosopher, The Destruction of Reason, you can see a similar stress on German irrationalism, but from rather different explanation. Now let's see what this good fight is between Bill and Dante. I'm glad it's between them and they're not getting me. Yes, I'm not. Well, I have to go. Yes, the Peikoff does have that view that the dominant philosophy determines what's going on within the culture. I would say this is one thing that got me into trouble with Peikoff doesn't know all that much about the German history of the time, so it would have helped if he studied the period a little more before he said all the things he did. Yes, I think that's right, that Mises does recognize that there can be gratifying labor. He doesn't think this applies to all labor. So I think you're right that I think Rand was not understanding what Mises had in mind there. Anish wants to know, if we only see the world as it appears to us, why does it need to posit the existence of a new world at all? Because Kant thought that we're not constructing everything that we see. We have what's given, something given to us in experience, is not a construction. So we apply our intuitions of space and time plus the categories to something that's given. So it's, if we rejected the noumenal world, then we would be saying we're constructing the whole experience. Now, there were some of the Kant's successors said just that. You know, one of the, I think, Kant's contemporary, Solomon Maimon, criticized and said, well, as long as you're suggesting we don't really have to have a new world. Some of the German idealists who followed Kant said that we can get rid of the new world, but that certainly wasn't Kant's view. Did Rothbard ever come to terms with the shame he felt for invading his tribe? No, he thought the whole thing was pretty much of a joke. He used to make fun of Nathaniel Brandon and various, all the people in the Rand Circle. Well, I guess we're about out of time now, so Danny says, yes, that's an interesting parallel Danny draws between omnipotent government. Kant, that Mises thought there was kind of a strain in German idealism, the totalitarian. One thing I'll be mentioning in my next lecture, and I'm going to deal with Mises' ethics a bit, that although Mises was a very much, somewhat of a Kantian in epistemology, he was definitely not in ethics. He was very strongly against Kantian ethics. So I guess we're about out of time now. So thanks very much, everybody, for coming to my lecture. And I'm glad, Bill, I'm glad I didn't need my bulletproof vest. Thanks very much, everybody. Okay, I hope I'll see you next week. Thank you.